From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
Obviously, they'll probably challenge us that we're going to assign them, but that's what the union does. You know, they look out for their membership.
The Boston Police Department pushes ahead with its body cams pilot program. We'll look at that and other stories in our Week in Review. Also today, what's ahead for Suffolk University after former President Margaret McKenna was fired by the board?
Now I think it's really about the Board of Trustees settling down and really working to build trust amongst the students and the faculty.
And balancing research, education, and advocacy at the New England Aquarium.
It's really essential the visitors who come here need to have a good time, but at the same time, begin to get a sense of what the ocean issues are.
That's all coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
African penguins, which are in this section of the exhibit. Little blue penguins over in that section of the exhibit.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, and that means time for the Week in Review. And we'll start today with Boston police and body cams. This week, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh says police officers will have to wear body cams, whether they like it or not.
We told the people in Boston we'd have a body camera program, and we're moving forward with a body camera program, and it's out in the street.
The police department decided to require 100 randomly selected officers to wear the cameras after no volunteers came forward for the city's pilot program. Here's reaction from NAACP Boston President Michael Curry.
If we can't anticipate that there'll be courage in law enforcement to get this done and that there's some resistance in the unions, then we have to require them to do it.
Thus far, police unions have not commented. So we'll talk about the pilot program and other news of the week with today's Week in Review panel, which includes Charlie Chipio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Charlie, great to see you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Also with us is Tom Keene. He's a former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, great to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so give both of you, give me your first line on this move that the Boston PD is going to require, require 100 randomly selected officers to wear body cams come September. Charlie, your take?
Well, my first take was just the fact that they didn't have a single volunteer, and that even offering a $500 stipend, they didn't have a single volunteer. I never imagined that this would be a popular thing, but the degree of the entrenched resistance to this, I have to say, really surprised me.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it really does show this kind of schism between the viewpoint of the entire outside world, which is calling for at least a test of this, if probably not full implementation, and then the ranks within the BPD, which is resisting it. And I don't understand why, because I think ultimately body cams are really going to help the cops.
Okay, so maybe, I mean, that's one take on it from both of you. But another take comes from Boston Police Patrolmen's Association President Patrick Rose. I mean, he told the Boston Herald this. It's a quote. He said, "It may be that the problem with officers actually volunteering occurred because of the timing of the announcement of the pilot program. The city decided to agree to this program within a week of 8 police officers being murdered in 2 separate cities." Of course, he's referring to Dallas and Baton Rouge there. And meanwhile, our members, BPD members, were screaming for protection, which was falling on deaf ears. I mean, I think he has a point there, that they felt like they weren't being heard, and then virtually at the same time, within 8 days, they were told, you're going to have to wear body cams, Charlie.
Well, it just seems to me that might be apples and oranges, in the sense that, yes, we need to do more to protect police. There's no doubt about that. But I think that anybody who has seen, you know, the film of, for example, the guy in South Carolina who was shot in the back as he was walking away, you know, and those kind of things, know that we also have problems here. And I have to say, all the evidence suggests that things are better in Boston than they are in a lot of these cities where these problems have happened. But, you know, just because we need to have more accountability, and specifically when it comes to African-American males, we need to show that we have some concern for their lives. That doesn't mean that's not exclusive of trying to do more to help the cops and ensure their safety.
Well, Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans told WGBH that he's expecting a challenge from the unions. Here's that.
Obviously, they'll probably challenge us that we're going to assign them, but that's what the union does. You know, they look out for their membership.
I mean, Tom, do you think that this decision could actually prolong the whole process?
Well, the fact that there's a challenge here suggests that the first excuse we heard from the BPD is not true, that it's not a timing issue, that in fact they're going to challenge it not because of timing, but because they don't want this to be done. I don't understand the rationale behind that, because I think in the long run we'll find that body cams and other forms of scrutiny like this are going to encourage citizens to trust and work with the police more effectively.
Mm. We've got a little bit more tape here from Commissioner Evans, because he said some interesting things. And again, this is courtesy of WGBH. He said that he actually spoke to all the officers at roll call to announce the decision, and then he said this.
You know, we have nothing to hide. This is a good program. And I think the younger officers get it. They're in on the technology. But the older officers who, it's a big change in the way they did policing.
Any credence to that, Charlie?
I think that there may be some truth to the fact that there's more resistance among the older officers. But it strikes me that not a single person volunteering also includes the younger officers.
True. The entire police force.
Right.
Yeah,
so, I mean, I can't imagine that they're completely bought into it.
Okay. So here's what I'm wondering. You know, beforehand, they were seeking volunteers. And a lot of people were wondering, okay, if volunteers had come forward, would these be the officers who would be least likely to...
be the good guys.
The good guys.
Right. Yeah.
Tom's
Bingo.
Words.
Yep.
And now, I mean, if by September we do have 100 randomly selected officers, I asked a guest on our show this earlier in the week, and I'm just wondering what the two of you think about it. You know, it seems as if we may actually have a greater sense of reality in terms of the experience of police officers and the citizens that they encounter every day because of the random selection here.
That was exactly my reaction, yes.
I think that's completely true. And a lot of people from the outside looking in at this were really wondering about the volunteer program. That, in fact, if you want to see whether this is effective, do it somewhat randomly, see what you're picking up, and see whether that then allows the pilot to go to a full-blown implementation.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's right.
Well, a lot of agreement at this table today.
Sorry about that.
But by the way, if anybody wants to pay me $500 to wear a body cam while I'm writing a column or something, I'm up for it. There'd be no problem.
I do want to reiterate that we have repeatedly reached out to the Boston Police Unions for comment, and they have not gotten back to us, and we'll keep doing so, and hopefully we'll hear from them. All right, well, let's move on to another story that really disturbed and captivated us this week that has to do with a report by the Disability Law Center that alleges a private special education school in Middleborough with abuse and neglect.
This school holds itself out as a therapeutic school. It is saying to families, we are specially set up to treat, to watch out, to take appropriate care. These youngsters come there with challenging behaviors, but they have to take adequate steps.
Well, that's Stan Eichner. He's director of litigation at the Disability Law Center. And some background here. The report that they put out alleges that staff at the Chamberlain International School did not do enough to prevent suicide attempts or prevent students from harming themselves. Some staff allegedly were verbally and emotionally abusive towards students. And allegedly, they did not supervise students well enough or have, allegedly, proper safety procedures in place. WBUR spoke to one parent, Jacqueline Dinan from Pembroke, New Hampshire, who sent her 13-year-old son to Chamberlain in 2014. She said he was verbally abused by staff and ended up running away, and that police were not notified by the school, but a civilian found Dinan's son.
My son just left the grounds and started running through people's yards, he told me, and I didn't know he was gone.
Now, of course, the Chamberlain International School denies the allegations. But Tom, let me just start with you. Your thoughts on this story?
So I've read the DLC's report. I've read the response from the school, and it's obviously hard to sort out fact from fiction. There's clearly enough here to suggest that it should go to the state regulatory agencies for investigation. But here's one thing that seems pretty clear to me: that the origin of this report was basically grounded in a custody battle between a non-custodial parent who made the allegations and the custodial parent who actually very much was supportive of the school. So it sounds like a little bit like it's a custody battle and divorce proceeding. Most of the allegations that initiated this particular investigation were in fact found not to be true. What happened is that in the course of the investigation, a number of other items, many of them already reported by the school, were brought to light, such as the fact that you had kids running away, such as the fact that the school actually had a standard for bullying that's an outmoded standard, mm-hmm. and one that clearly is not in keeping with where the state law is today. But I'm a little bit wary about a lot of the smoke from here and not sure that there's as much fire there as we think.
Charlie?
Well, I got to tell you, I have a very personal take on this because I have two kids that are in therapeutic schools. And, you know, this reading about this, it all rang true. I mean, it's exactly what I experienced, which is that you have the same school and you have kids who are well suited for that school and who are a good fit for that school. And the parents will tell you this is the greatest place in the world. You have the exact same school and you have kids who are not a good fit for that school. And it will sound like a torture chamber. And you know, I think that every SPED parent who has kids in these therapeutic schools, you know, has been through this. And I think that my take from this is that the real issue here is that you have a process in which you are having to fight school districts tooth and nail to get them to agree to this, no matter what your kids have been through.
Because the district funds
the district doesn't
the school.
Want to do it. The yeah. district will tell you, oh, we can handle this no matter what.
Yeah, they don't want to pay for it.
Right, because they have to pay for
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and no matter, I mean, you know, I have my own experiences with this. And yet, so, you know, and then finally, you know, after you've gotten paid for the lawyer and the advocate and all this stuff, and you finally sort of get them to agree to do this, you're faced with a situation that you are totally unprepared for, which is trying to pick which school is correct for your kid, which is, I mean, it's just, it's overwhelming. And so that's why I think you very often get these situations where you have a mix of kids who are well-suited and doing well and other kids who are really a poor fit.
So Charlie, help us get some insight here then, because you do have experience in this. Because one of the things that I wondered, which was a question that was raised by Shannon Dooling, WBR's reporter, who's been doing extensive yeah. reporting on this. I mean, she talked to 24 families, or parents and families. And she pointed out that these schools they seek to support, you know, kids with a wide variety of challenges, but they are mandated to do so in the least restrictive environment possible.
That's
and
right.
So oftentimes that's a very hard balance to strike, especially when the challenges that the kids are facing are so varied.
It's a very hard balance, and that's why in this case you have kids who, you know, who part of the problem is apparently that they're leaving the campus. Well, of course, you know, they're trying to make it as unrestrictive as possible.
It's not a jail.
It's right.
Right.
It's not
a locked facility.
You know, it's very difficult. And you get some of these facilities, some of these schools, for example, who really focus on, you know, saying we're not for kids who have behavioral problems, for example. Yet no matter how much you try, the screening process fails sometimes and you end up with kids that have behavioral problems and they're not really equipped to handle them and causes all kinds of problems both for the kid and for the rest of the class.
But as Tom pointed out, having outmoded standards for bullying, certainly, I mean, that can't be acceptable.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
No, believe me, I'm certainly not trying to say that they are blameless and all this kind of stuff. I'm just saying that this whole what's happened here is part of a much bigger and more complex problem.
Well, Tom and Charlie, I'll turn back to you on this, but do you have any thoughts on then how state oversight could improve or maybe regulatory changes that might actually help in this situation?
Well, it does raise the question. I mean, first of all, the DLC actually is federally authorized and it is part of kind of the regulatory structure, albeit at a federal level.
Right.
But it is state authorities that do it. The school has actually pointed out on a number of occasions that as far as the state regulators are concerned, it's okay. Now, if that's really the case in terms of the bullying standard, and that was the most disturbing thing, I think, to me that actually came out of here because it was so current and seemed so prevalent, and the school was actually defending it, saying that this isn't bullying when I think to an outside person it looks like bullying, that starts to suggest that maybe we need to have some stepped up state regulation or oversight. And, you know, again, I haven't looked at the budget on it, but my guess is you're going to find that you have a regulatory agency that is somewhat strapped for funds, as we've seen yeah. across the board on a whole variety of issues. And, you know, you need to have the money come from somewhere. We don't have a state budget right now that's really dramatically expanding.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, anybody who thinks that, you know, the whole thing with the Department of Children and Families, mm-hmm. you know, that's a horrible thing and we're working to fix it. You know, I think anybody who thinks that if we didn't dig into a whole variety of other human service agencies, we wouldn't find similar things, unfortunately, right. is naive.
Mm. Well, we'll keep taking a look at this issue, because I feel like there's a lot more to discuss, and we'll definitely do that in the days and weeks ahead. But before we run out of too much time, I actually just wanted to talk about the weather a little bit. Because
sunny and dry.
Sunny and dry. We'd need some major rainfall, so here's some tape.
Dairy farmers do not have hay or pasture to graze because it's all burnt up, so they don't have food. Cranberry growers don't have water to do harvest in the fall. Vegetable crop growers don't have enough water to water their vegetables. They take a lot of water, and so a lot of them have to make the hard decision of which fields do we abandon and which do we water.
Well, that's Michael Smolak, a third-generation farmer in North Andover. On Thursday, the U.S. Drought Monitor more than quadrupled the area of the state of Massachusetts considered to be under extreme drought. That now includes nearly 17% of the state's landmass. And so Governor Baker urged residents to conserve water.
We had a pretty light winter, and we found an incredibly dry summer. And those things by themselves have consequences for farming and consequences for agriculture generally, but they also have public safety issues, which we think are important for people to keep in mind as well.
160 communities, have instituted some kind of restriction on water use. Tom, I mean, do you think that the Baker administration may consider even statewide water restrictions?
It may. I mean, I think a couple of things. First of all, we're now learning to regret the mild winter we had.
Yeah.
Okay. Because if we had had a lot of snowfall, we wouldn't have had this. Yeah. We wouldn't have this issue right now. The second is, as bad as it is here, it's a lot worse, say, in places like California. And we should really kind
and
of
it's constant
that.
There.
And it's constant there. And we really should keep that in mind. We may very well need to start going over to more restrictive types of controls. Let's see what the next few weeks bring in terms of weather. I know we're in a drought situation right now. This is not a crisis situation for most of the state.
Yeah, it seems like things are not as bad once you get outside 495 and move west. Not to say things
knock
are
on
wonderful.
Wood, right? Yeah, right.
No,
you know,
right.
The thing though is we also this week had that news that July was the hottest July since this is an exaggeration, but since records basically were
that's no exaggeration.
That's exactly right. So that makes me wonder. I mean, okay, so we may not be in sort of a California type crisis here in Massachusetts yet, but it seems like we ought to be thinking, and maybe some at the state and local level about how to deal with, you know, year after year of this kind of weather.
No, I mean, look, I agree with that. The last time I took one science class in college, which was an astronomy class called Great Moments in Astronomy, which was designed for, you know, sort of science for writers like me. But look, it just certainly appears to me that it's a stretch to try to claim that something is not going on with the climate and that we certainly need to move sooner rather than later and very aggressively to start addressing these issues, or our kids, certainly I think it could be that soon, are going to have to face some issues that we shouldn't force them to face.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's exactly right. This is becomes increasingly hard for anyone who's rational to dispute the notion that there really is human-induced climate change, and that's what we're seeing here.
Well, let's have a little bit of happy news to wrap up this week's Week in Review. It's time for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe didn't get the attention we think they deserved this week. And Charlie, let's start with your hubbub.
Well, I do. Mine is a happy one. I want to just talk a little bit about Topsfield's own Abby D'Agostino, this woman who was running in the 5,000-meter race in the Olympics, and she by mistake tripped up another woman. They both fell, and instead of just moving on, she stopped and urged the other woman. Her name was Nikki Hamblin from New Zealand. Said, "It's the Olympics. You got to finish." And she got up and she did do that. And Abby, the woman from Topsfield, did the same thing, meaning that she ran the last 2,000 meters of the race with a torn anterior cruciate ligament.
Ow!
Which is unheard of, I think. And you know, the two of them have been great in terms of how much they sort of appreciated each other, and it's just been a really nice kind of a nice moment in the whole sort of Olympics, which has had a a little bit of a checkered history and some of the some other issues right now in these current Olympics as well. So I think it's been sort of a moment for us to all focus on what's good about the Olympics.
Olympic, the height of a true Olympic spirit.
The Olympic spirit, exactly.
Tom, you're going to bring us the depths.
I'm going to bring us to the depths of the Olympic experience. And that those depths happen to be American swimmer Ryan Lochte, who likes to present himself as a goofball and an oddball. But his antics in Brazil, where, if you remember, he falsely claimed he was robbed at gunpoint, when in fact it was he and some teammates who drunkenly busted up a gas station restroom, those were none of those things. They were vicious, wrong, and played into people's bigotry and prejudices. And they were also reminiscent to me of Boston's 1989 Charles Stewart incident. In that notorious case, Stewart murdered his pregnant wife for insurance money, but he pinned the blame on an anonymous black attacker. Back then, the media swallowed whole Stewart's lies, eager to believe the narrative of an African-American inner-city urban crime. So, too, American media this time around eagerly believed Lochte, as his story fed into this widespread narrative of Brazil as an out-of-control country near collapse. Lochte has now apologized, but frankly, I think that's not enough. He's a national embarrassment. He's a man who, trying to cover up his own crime, smeared a people and a nation. He's no longer fit to represent the U.S. in any future Olympics, or for that matter, in any future contest whatsoever.
I think you make an excellent point that, I mean, there's so much going on in this story, and the comparisons are really interesting, but really, I feel like all of us, when Lochte first said, claimed, like, we were held, everybody believed him.
Sure,
right.
Yeah, and that, and, you know, shame on all
of us. And he got out of town in time, whereas these other two guys, they went, got on the plane and
they were
dragged
off
the plane.
So. Yeah, and, I mean, his apology, in quotes, I'm going to put that in quotes, was not really
sort of
that
like
much
a Donald Trump apology.
Right.
It was not it was a non-apology apology, I've read. It really was very weak.
And it's really too bad because the Brazilians didn't deserve that treatment, and it also really overshadowed, for a while, all the great stuff that's been happening at this Games, especially from Team USA. All right, so I am going to wrap up with a totally different kind of sport. It's a little preview. My hubbub's a preview of tomorrow on the Charles River. The Red Bull Flugtag is coming to Boston.
Right.
And that's where teams get together and they build flying machines and they hurdle these flying machines off a roughly 28-foot platform and they plunge into the Charles River. It's really quite a sight to see, and we've got teams from all over Massachusetts. We've got Northeastern University teams. We've got MIT teams from the Draper Lab. There's a bunch of them from the Draper Lab. There's one representing Boston schools here, the Boston School District. I want to see if I can find their entry information. I'm looking for it right now, and now I can't find it. But it's pretty funny because they all try to trash talk each other. Here it is. The name of the team is Mass Instruction. What they're building. They're building a pencil with lined paper for wings, and they have and teams get to trash talk each other, and the BPS teacher's trash talk is, we may not be experts, but those who underestimate our ability will be inside for recess. So the Flugtag coming to the Charles River tomorrow. I'm going to do my best to be there. It'll be fun to watch. That is the end of this week's Week in Review. Charlie Chippio, Senior Fellow at the Pioneer Institute. Always great to have you, Charlie. Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Thanks, Tom.
My pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, the Rio Olympics wrap up on Sunday, and Shira Springer, Olympics columnist for the Boston Globe, has been our woman on the ground in Rio, and she joins us now. Hi, Shira.
Hello.
So I want to talk to you about these last few days of these great Olympic Games, but we got to start off with basically what's turned out to be kind of an international geopolitical incident with U.S. swimmer Ryan Lochte. He finally issued an apology saying, quote, I want to apologize for my behavior last weekend, for not being more careful and candid in how I described the events of that early morning. And those events, of course, being his claim that he and other fellow U.S. swimmers were held at gunpoint and robbed. It turned out that was not the case at all. How is this playing out in Rio, Shira?
Needless to say, not well. You have a lot of angry Brazilians, and particularly a lot of angry members of the police force here who feel that Ryan really played on the perception that street crime, violent street crime, is rampant in this city. Now, listen, there have been legitimate incidents of violent crime committed against Olympic visitors and even Olympic athletes. But at this point, it seems very clear that Lochte made up this story of an armed robbery. So a lot of angry Brazilians, a lot of angry IOC officials, and quite frankly, a lot of angry Americans, because you know what? This takes away from all that the U.S. team is accomplishing here in Rio. So all of this has become not just a huge distraction, but a huge embarrassment.
Well, you know, I mean, it seems as if the only thing that Lochte had been truthful about was the fact that he and his fellow swimmers on that night were drunk, to be perfectly honest. He didn't talk about, he initially hadn't mentioned anything about vandalizing the gas station's bathroom, which was later caught on camera and then later revealed that's what happened. Of course, we should say Ryan Lochte is back in the United States. A fellow U.S. swimmer says he's going to pay roughly $11,000, I believe, to a charity as well. But I want to read a couple other lines from Lochte's apology. He said, quote, "It's traumatic to be out late with your friends in a foreign country with a language barrier and have a stranger point a gun at you and demand money to let you leave." I mean, to your point a little earlier, one of the things that brings the world together around the Olympics and the Olympic Games is that it's supposed to be a time of global fellowship and athletes as ambassadors. And yet news outlets around the world, I saw France 24 saying Ryan Lochte, the ugly American, or the new face of the ugly American.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely accurate at this point. There are certain things you do as a responsible grown up when an incident like this happens that clearly Ryan Lochte didn't do. This is a guy who is an attention seeker from the start. Let's not forget that he arrived at the Olympics with his hair dyed sort of a shocking hue of silver blue. This is a guy who had his own reality TV show, What Would Ryan Lochte Do? And I think he saw an opportunity here in some respect to seize that spotlight, it was very misguided on his part. And then he issues this apology. I mean, just to go back to the apology, he kind of apologizes without actually saying what he did wrong.
Well, he says he accepts responsibility for my role in this happening and have learned some very valuable lessons. Well, congratulations, Ryan Lochte. You learned some lessons, but I'm wondering, could there be any further repercussions? I mean, could Brazil press charges?
I think the most severe penalty for Ryan Lochte and his swimming teammates may be what the USOC and USA Swimming does. I think a suspension for all of them is coming down the pike, because you can't behave this way and while you're representing the country, while you're representing USA Swimming, and not suffer some repercussions from the organizations that sent you there and fund your training.
Right. Well, let's get back to talking about the things that the Olympics should be about, which is joyful and inspiring feats of athleticism. And I'm talking about Usain Bolt's 200-meter final run. You were at the Olympic Stadium last night for that. Was it as electric as his 100-meter win?
I would say, honestly, not maybe a shade. Not as electric, just because it was sort of his middle race, even though it's the race that he cares about the most, or so he says. Also, he's going to race again tonight. So I think there was sort of like, okay, he's got to get this one done, and then he can go 3 for 3, hopefully, with the 4x100 relay. That all being said, there is not a time when Usain Bolt takes the track when the atmosphere is not heightened. Part of that is anticipation of what he's going to do, because when he steps on the track, there's always the possibility of a world record. And part of it is just his personality and the way he embraces the moment. And that's sometimes the most fun part to watch. It certainly lasts longer than his races. I mean, he was racing for less than 20 seconds last night, finished in 1978. I mean, the whole theater of it is part of the fun of being at a Usain Bolt race. And the interesting thing was, as we were actually after the race waiting to talk with him about the race and kind of get his feelings on it, the United States Olympic Committee and USA Swimming were releasing statements about Ryan Lochte. I mean, it was just sort of this interesting also dichotomy of Olympic events occurring on one night. You have Ryan Lochte and the embarrassment there, and then all that you hope the Olympics should be in Usain Bolt celebrating on the track and being celebrated.
Yeah. Well, Shira Springer is the Olympics columnist for the Boston Globe and our woman on the ground in Rio. It's been great to check in with you during these games, Shira. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
In a little over a week, Suffolk University will begin its fall term with a new president. Marissa Kelly will be the sixth president in 6 years for Suffolk. She'll lead the school as interim president after former president Margaret McKenna was fired by the Board of Trustees in late July. Despite the churn and tumult at the top, students and faculty, the heart and soul of Suffolk University, soldier on, and we wanted to see how they're doing. Joining us now is David Yamada, law professor and director of the New Workplace Institute at Suffolk. Welcome back to Radio Boston, David.
Thank you, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, I mean, give us a sense. What has it been like from the faculty perspective of all of this tumult and change that's been going on?
Well, I think you captured the heart of it. When you talk about five or six presidents in 5 or 6 years, the effect is very distracting at minimum. But for many of us, I think we can say it's been unsettling and demoralizing to see this play occur before our eyes at a university that many of us have devoted our careers to and on behalf of many students who deserve better than what they're seeing before them.
Yeah, so I want to talk to you about students and faculty dedication in just a moment. But when you talk about the sense of demoralization and all of this playing out before your eyes, I mean, one of the issues is that, of course, a little bit of background, there was just a lot of tension and outright fighting between President McKenna or former President McKenna and the Suffolk board. But much of that was played out in the press. And I've heard complaints about, you know, that people, faculty and students didn't really find out what was going on except for reading the pages of the Boston Globe and listening to other media like WBUR. I mean, how much problematic was that?
Exactly. When you have to look to see what's in the Globe or on the radio to find out what's happening in your own backyard and to discover what the latest machinations are between the board and the president of the university, it makes for a daily soap opera that sucks up a lot of time, energy, and enthusiasm, while at the same time, you know, you're just trying to hang on enough to do the wonderful work that you get to do as a faculty member or as an administrator or staff member.
Mm. Well, you are the director of the New Workplace Institute at Suffolk, which is another interesting reason why we're glad that you're here, because I still, you know, this afternoon I turned and asked the Radio Boston staff, I said, God, can you guys imagine what it would be like if we had 5 different general managers at WBUR in 5 consecutive years? I mean, we couldn't even wrap our heads around how the upheaval and the uncertainty that would bring.
It is a game of adjusting to a new leadership style, new messaging, sometimes inconsistent messaging, sometimes less than forthright messaging. I guess you nailed this fact that as somebody who studies the workplace, it's especially ironic to me to see this and to see the effects on myself and my coworkers.
Well, so what have faculty done then to hold up morale as all this is going on?
Well, the faculty does have some avenues through various committees, task forces, senates, and so forth to try and respond to what's going on. But I think a lot of the morale building has just been very much within ourselves. We work at an institution that, despite many, many strengths, has historically been a very top-down kind of institution. So that is why you're alluding to us reading the Globe or listening to BUR to find out what's going on, because we're not getting the kind of interaction and communication with our leadership that one would hope for at a university that has such promise as Suffolk.
Mm. Now, one of the things that I imagine that I'm just going to say that I think everyone wants when they go to work every day is to feel a sense of pride for the organization that they're giving their time and their resources and their goodwill to. I mean, do you think faculty and students still feel that sense of pride?
I guess to answer your question, I'd say maybe it's somewhat bifurcated. I think we are proud of our students. You know, Suffolk students, they are smart, they are hardworking, they are by and large unspoiled, right? They are a pleasure to work with. We have a lot of great things going on at this university. But I think the painful piece of it is to see how this soap opera, as I called it, has become not only a regional but a national story of dysfunction. And I will say, I don't think the faculty and the students are at fault at this. We have been kind of left out of the equation in terms of participation and input. And so we're having to see a place that deserves much better be torn down in public for reasons that are have been, frankly, beyond our control.
I mean, this is especially interesting given Suffolk's unique and interesting history, right? A fascinating history. I mean, this was a school that was founded to give opportunity to Bostonians and students who might not otherwise have those opportunities. I mean, what first drew you to working at Suffolk?
I like the idea of a private, regional, urban university that in Suffolk's case is at the crossroads, literally and figuratively, of this city. And that remains one of the real attractions of being at this university. And if we could only address the stuff at the top, there's so much untapped potential for this place that could just explode if we had the right kind of support and leadership.
Well, right now, I think Suffolk is facing a whole matrix of challenges that stem from this leadership battle. Faculty morale, as we've been talking about, you know, student morale. You want to still continue to draw exactly the kind of students that could best benefit from Suffolk education. Alumni now are starting to say, you know, is this the kind of place we want to maintain our relationship with? But the public image at Suffolk has really taken a hit. I mean, what do you think could be done to repair that image?
I think we need a very, very new attitude and perhaps some significant changes at the board level. I also think we need a new president who has the commitment and the gravitas to put on a different public face of this university. I actually thought that Margaret McKenna was that person, and personally I'm very dismayed at how she was dismissed. But given the fact that that is in the past, I hope that our next president will have many of the qualities that she had, as well as being someone who recognizes that this school can do a lot of great things if the people at the top are better stewards of the institution.
We have about 10 seconds left. Do you think that changes should be made at the board level?
I hope we'll see some change at the board level in both policy and in some cases in personnel.
Well, David Yamada is a law professor and director of the New Workplace Institute at Suffolk University, giving us a window into how faculty and students are feeling with all the tumult that's been going on there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
If you can hear my voice, but you can't see me, I am in the penguin exhibit, in the water, directly across from the glass doors where you first entered the aquarium this morning.
That's the delightful sound we were greeted with when we went to the New England Aquarium yesterday. We were there to meet Aquarium CEO Nigella Hillgarth.
So the penguins are my favorites because I used to work on them.
We were surrounded by kids and parents, visitors from around the world, all craning their necks over the glass walls of the penguin enclosure, trying to get a glimpse of the aquarium's tuxedoed stars.
Our timing's perfect, isn't it? Maybe a little too perfect.
African penguins, which are in this section of the exhibit. Little blue penguins over in that section of the exhibit.
So we moved to a quieter corner of the aquarium on a ramp bathed in the blue light of the aquarium's giant ocean tank. Nigella Hillgarth has been the president and CEO of the New England Aquarium since May of 2014. In that time, the former penguin scientist has faced some pointed criticism about how she's positioned the New England Aquarium into an advocacy role rather than strictly education and research. For example, Hillgarth supports legislation that seeks to ban the sale of shark fins and has pushed for the creation of a marine monument in portions of the Gulf of Maine. So we talked about the challenges of moving from research to advocacy with Hillgarth, but first we had to start with the penguins.
Well, we came in through the front doors here. You said that the penguins were your favorite. Can you tell us why?
Yes, they are my favorites. And it's because I used to study them. I used to be a zoologist, and I've done research on penguins in the more sort of warmer parts of the world. So I studied penguins in the Galapagos and in Peru and looked at the impacts of stress on penguins.
And I'm going to guess that too much stress is bad for penguins, just as it's bad for humans.
That's a very good guess, yes. We actually happened to be there in an El Nino year and then came back the next year and found that, you know, lack of food when the water heats up and the fish go away is obviously very stressful for these birds. They don't have enough to eat. And then they recovered very quickly when the fish came back.
Well, good. So they're resilient then, at least. They
tend
to bounce back.
They are resilient.
Well, let's go back in time a little bit, because we'd love to hear your story about what spawned your love of the natural world and of science. You grew up in Ireland, right?
I grew up deep in the Irish countryside in Tipperary, and I was very lucky. We grew up in front of a large lake, lots of woods, and so nature was all around me. So that I think that's what really sparked my interest.
Yeah. So can you tell us a story? I mean, when we were doing our preparation for this, I just love the story about your close encounter with an otter.
Well, that really was a, you know, life-changing event for me, I think, because when you have a real encounter with another animal, when you're looking into its eyes, that can be life-changing. I'm not sure if it was for the otter, but it certainly was for me. So I was in a little blind that I had made of branches quite close to the lake, not far from the house. And I was looking at birds on the lake. And then suddenly I looked down and this very young otter, probably a few months old, was crossing in front of the blind just at, almost at my feet. And it either smelt me or saw me, and it looked up. And I looked down, we both stopped moving and just stared at each other for a long time. And it was, to me as a child, it seemed like having a conversation. And then eventually the otter moved on and I was thrilled. It was a moment that I never forgot.
How old were you?
I was about 8 or 9, I think.
Wow.
At the time.
And so you had a capacity for observation and stillness at that young age.
Well, I suppose, put it that way, yes, I guess I did. I realized very early on that was the only way that I could really observe animals.
Yeah. Well, before we talk a little bit more about how you went from that to your career in science, can we just take a little detour? Because I have to ask you about your father. I was trying to think of a fun but respectful way of saying this. He was something of a meddler himself. I mean, a spy for Great Britain during the Second World War, is that true?
That is true, actually, yes. He was in intelligence during the Second World War. In fact, even before that, he was naval attaché in Madrid and in charge of British intelligence in that area.
Looking back now, was there any evidence of the influence of his experiences that sort of bled into your childhood in terms of how he helped you look at the world or the opportunities that he gave to you?
I think he'd been through a lot. He fought in the First World War as well, the Spanish Civil War, and then the Second World War. And so I knew him as somebody who was really retired, writing books, and taking enormous value in the little things in life. So it wasn't his actual being a spy that impacted me. It was how he valued peace and how he valued the world.
Uh-huh. Interesting. But you didn't follow a sort of a conventional path into being a world-traveling scientific researcher, though, right? I mean, because I read that you did eventually go to Oxford University, but not until you were in your 20s?
That's true, actually, yes. I always knew I wanted to work with animals. Apparently, I marched around the house, age 5, saying, I'm an animal lover, and to me, it's a very logical path. But I think I was brought up at a time and in a society where women didn't necessarily go to university. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that somebody said to me, you know, you're so passionate about animals and science, you really do need to go to university. And I hadn't realized that I was intelligent enough to go to university. I'm quite dyslexic, and though I've really got over that, but at the time I didn't realize that that's one of the reasons I hadn't flourished in academia.
Who told you? Well, I mean, who was the person who told you that you should go to university?
Oh, that was a wonderful woman, Janet Keir, who worked at the place where I was working at the Wildfowl and Wetland Trust, which was a lovely place in southern England, and I was looking after the birds and having a wonderful time. And she said, you know, I think you should get a degree and you should take this seriously. So she was, you know how you have mentors in life? She was one of those special people who helped to push me towards that.
Oh, wow. So it's never been easy for women in science. And I mean, what was it like for you? Because you, when you went to Oxford, you were obviously a woman, but you were also older than sort of other entering students might have been. So what was that like?
I was 27. I was called a mature student. but I was lucky. I went to Somerville College, which then was still all women. It's co-ed now. And I had another wonderful mentor there, Marion Dawkins, who she encouraged women to go into science and to realize that they could be just as good as anyone else. She had a very distinguished career herself.
Now, did you say her name was Marion Dawkins?
Yes.
Related to Richard Dawkins?
She was married to Richard at the time.
Okay.
Yes.
So you have had a tremendous career doing, I mean, we talked about your penguin research. What prompted you to make the transition from doing scientific research in the field to where you find yourself now, more, you know, running a big institution like the New England Aquarium? Why did you make that transition?
Well, I think a sort of thread running through this for me was what was beginning to happen to the environment. And, you know, I'm an evolutionary biologist by training, and going to all these different places, began to see habitat degradation, smuggling of rare species, all these things that were a concern to me, and I felt that the public was not hearing about this. And so that I got very worried about the future of our planet and the disconnect between people who were not studying these things and what was happening. And so I got more and more interested in talking to the public.
That gets us to what you hope for the New England Aquarium now, because, I mean, what do you see as sort of the primary mission for the New England Aquarium, given the state of our oceans today?
I think it's really essential that the visitors who come here need to have a good time, but at the same time begin to get a sense of what the ocean issues are and what we need to do to actually make some of these things better in the ocean. Ocean optimism, I like to call it.
Yeah. I mean, in our conversation so far, I've definitely heard that this sense of you being personally connected to the environment is a very animating force in your life, and trying to bring that sense of connection, encourage that same sense of connection for people who visit, is very a meaningful mission to you. But there's also, there comes some controversy in the question of how far should the aquarium go in, you know, its mission to create that connection, because there are some people who say that maybe under your leadership they feel that the aquarium is being taking on too much of an advocacy role.
Well, you know, I say to that the aquarium has actually always taken on an advocacy role. I think we just may be a little louder about it. The aquarium has testified in Congress about Stillwagon Bank, for example. But I liken it to, well, it's not an exact analogy, but if you think of an art museum standing by and not saying anything while great works of art are being destroyed, deliberately or not, they're going to speak up and say something. And so I think the aquarium has always done that, and I'm continuing that. But what we're doing is shaping that in hopefully a very constructive and solution-oriented way.
So before we wrap up, since we are here at the aquarium, it's one of my favorite sights.
Oh, I know. Sea turtles are really something, aren't they?
They're amazing. What a beauty. Okay, you're not allowed to pick one of the charismatic animals here, not the penguins or the sea turtles, but one of your other favorite animals that we can see at the aquarium.
Well, I actually love the monkfish. I don't know if you're familiar with the monkfish. She's rather ugly. She's very flat. She once a year lays the most beautiful purple veil of eggs. It's thousands and thousands of eggs, all knitted together like a very gossamer purple veil. It's one of the most extraordinary and beautiful experiences. So I'd have to say that's one of my favorites.
And 5 or 10 years from now, what would you like to see for the New England Aquarium? What's your vision?
My vision is hopefully the same energy that you hear today. I think now when people leave, about 40% say they want to do something to help the oceans. I'd like to double that. I'd like to have to bring the ocean in here more and to take people out to the ocean. To me, success is if they actually want to go spend time on the real thing.
Well, thank you so much for having us over at the aquarium, and best of luck to you in helping all of us continue to appreciate all the things that the ocean has to offer. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for coming here. It's been really fun. Thank you.
That was Nigella Hillgarth, president and CEO of the New England Aquarium, and my frequent distraction there, those silent cameos by Myrtle the sea turtle. That's it for this Friday edition of Radio Boston. Have a great weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.